So welcome back, and we'll start as usual with a relaxation, setting the motivation, a little review, just to get our minds right in the zone. Again, just to remind you, if you've, to make sure that you're practicing in the supine as well as sitting up, just to get used to it. You know, very helpful. So checking your position. Drawing the mind inward. Paying attention to how your whole body is responding to each in-breath and out-breath. Each in-breath and out-breath. Allowing one part of your mind to gently scan your whole body. And when you note any areas of tension, simply release it naturally on the out-breath. Beginning to notice the result of the release of the tension, especially in the face, the relaxation of all the facial muscles, the unclenching of the jaw, the smooth forehead, the spaciousness around the eyes and between the eyes. And how all this relaxation is generating waves of relaxation, which gently flow down the body and through the body. And wherever they touch, all relaxation deepens, all tension eases. Your shoulders have given up a burden and have dropped to a much more comfortable position. Releasing, all the time releasing any tension on the out-breath. To give you some stability, focus now on the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Just stay there, the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Shifting your focus to the in-breath, simply become aware without any effort on your part, that with each in-breath, your mind is becoming brighter, sharp, clear, naturally on each in-breath. And with a relaxed body and a sharp mind, now we set our motivation. Infuse it with bodhicitta. Bring it to the front of your mind and just gently focus on that. When you're happy to do so, if you want to, you can do some prayers. Very helpful. Sangye chudam soke chunam la janju bardu dagni kyap suchi dagi jin soke pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupar sho Sangye chudam soke chunam la janju bardu dagni kyap suchi dagi jin soke pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupar sho. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Good. So before we begin, just a very brief review. Any feedback from your personal practice time? How's that going? Yes. Yes, dear.
Can you hear me okay?
I can go. Yes, I can.
Okay, good. So Carol and I both tried the supine position yesterday afternoon and this morning, and goodness me, it's so different.
Mm.
So
In what way is it different?
Able to get into the relaxation more.
Yes, yes.
Quicker.
So quick.
Yeah, and I managed to stay awake, which is great. And yesterday afternoon, for me, the mind and its contents was a bit clearer. This morning, not so much, but, you know, I managed to obtain the mind that you, that just kind of, when thoughts come in, just kind of go,
Yes.
So I was very pleased.
Good. Well done. Well done. There's a lot of power in personal practice. There really is. Sometimes listening to people like me can be a form of entertainment. Really, much better you practice, much better. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to give me a feedback? Yes, Mikhail.
Hello, Venerable Mayor.
Hello.
I just want to give you a little feedback concerning your doubts about bliss as an antidote to excitement. I pondered a lot about it, and I actually had a class two nights ago with the Mahamudra and done some other meditations where I tried to apply that question. And it seems to make a lot of sense to me, actually, in the way that, if we describe bliss as we would usually in like normal common terminology, which is like some happy, freaky
Yeah.
You know? But if you take bliss as, as the, even, you know, kind of the purpose why we do shamatha, you know, the quiet but aware state where we get in contact with some kind of primordial mind as much as we can at this stage, you know, but that experience to me is always very blissful and very peaceful at the same time. And I have the sense also on a, you know, on a physical level that excitement and anxiety is often connected to the to an overflow of or overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system.
Yes, it is.
Excitement, too much tension going on in the body.
And the release kicks in the parasympathetic.
Exactly. So, okay. the blissful states of Mahamudra or other the deep meditations work to me as an it has worked as an antidote to my system because I activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And it kind of releases the component which seems to be prevalent in anxiety, which is too much future, being anxious about the future, and brings me into the present moment and a state of being safe, connected, grounded, happy.
I think, I mean, you've gone into it deeper than me. I think what I was trying to say yesterday was the other four antidotes to the five obscurations, you can see your way to coarsely trying to apply them. That's what, but the fifth one, bliss, because bliss is described, I mean, even trying to get a description of bliss, the most you'll get is this is a quality of the substrate consciousness. It's 1,000 times better than sex. That's the way they say it. It's really bears no relationship to what you think is bliss. So what I was trying to say is the other four, you can kind of see course examination, precise and best, this type of thing. You can see a course way of applying that. But the real healing of the antidotes to those, of course, lies within the consciousness itself. And so the first four, you could kind of get a wee bit in and try coarsely to apply it. But I find it quite difficult to apply bliss. So I think bliss would be the one that, well, they all come from that calm mind, from that substrate consciousness. They all do. But it's just the first four, you can kind of see yourself saying, okay, you know, I have afflictive uncertainty. I'm going to apply some precise investigation. Now, whatever you do at this stage will be quite coarse, but you can do something. Whereas really the bliss bit, my feeling is you have to wait for that. I don't think you can apply it coarsely. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's the point is like the other ones. You have to do the choice and you have to decide for yourself that you want to be in a state where you have another state of mind. But of course you can't go from one directly to the other. So, I mean, my experience would be that I would take the times I had in my life where I was more peaceful already and then deepen that. And that would be an antidote over
that
time.
That would certainly be a step towards it. That would certainly be a step towards it. Yeah. I think I'll wait for it just to arise naturally.
And that's the thing I find that it does, you know, meditation, if you just get a little bit of taste of peace in the body and mind, you're getting closer to bliss anyway. That's what I find.
I think you have a point because the way people that I've met talk about it, it's like nothing that I could compare it to here. But sometimes it's a bit like people often give the analogy is that if you're looking at a sunbeam, you're not looking at the sun. But follow that sunbeam and you get to the sun. So maybe helpful. Thank you, Miguel. Thank you. Welcome. Anyone else? Do feedback? No? Okay. So maybe just settle yourself again just for a bit of reflection. Try to bring to mind, if you can remember yesterday, anything that we talked about. Just to get your mind in the zone. Relaxing the body on the out-breath. Sharpening your mind on the in-breath. Making sure your mind is deeply inward. And so the mantra with settling the mind in its natural state. Without grasping. Without distraction. How does that feel to you now? If you were to explain that to anyone, what would you say? Without grasping, without distraction. dealing with all difficulties in the same way, very lightly. It's a very light dealing. If dullness, arousing your attention on the in-breath with excitation and anxiety, releasing on the out-breath and refocusing. Can you see how that's the same in every meditation we've done? Have we got a good grasp on the understanding that thoughts, in whatever way they come, is not a problem? We're not trying to banish thoughts. We're not trying to engender beautiful thoughts or get rid of bad thoughts. Thoughts, not the problem. The real job is observing as they arise, not engaging. See their nature. Don't push them away. Don't Velcro yourself to them. Just see their nature and they will disappear on their own. They have no power. Consider the analogy we used. What does it mean to you now? Don't be like a hitchhiker. Be like a kestrel. Try to put that into words in your mind. What does that mean? Don't be like a hitchhiker. Be like a kestrel. Imagine someone is next to you saying, but why do I have to keep my eyes open for this type of meditation? I do much better with my eyes closed. What would you say? Is it the situation that even if you have a lot of thoughts, you can apply these antidotes quite easily? But isn't it true there seems to be quite a few periods where you have no thoughts? When you have no thoughts, what do you do? You try to make your awareness a bit more refined, a bit more subtle. Try to detect the movement in the mind, which is often a precursor to thoughts. Or thoughts that are just beginning, making yourself more subtle. Now, what would happen is you've done that, but there are still more thoughts, no movement in the ether, everything's calm. What do you do then? How comfortable are you for simply being aware of the empty space of the mind? The object is the empty space of the mind and or any events that arise. Thank you. I'm hoping you're finding these brief reviews useful, just to get the mind in the right zone. Okay. So I suppose what I'd like to talk about now here, at this stage that we're at, is really remembering, if you find your mind constricted, if you find your body constricted or tight, you need to notice this and relax it immediately. Whenever you notice there's you're losing clarity, you need to remedy that. Now, sometimes when you're having a really difficult day, that may mean going into the supine position, getting yourself comfortable in the supine. Now you don't have to worry about relaxing. Sometimes that is enough. Remember right at the very beginning, one of the main reasons in the beginning of shamatha for failure is the inability to relax. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says later on, failure comes from too high an expectation of what you think you can achieve or how quickly you want to achieve. So having any expectation, His Holiness says this quite clearly. So we want to think about that a bit. Now, there may be a time when there is a possibility that, I always say you can't relax enough, but it's, in one hand it's true, but there is such a thing as excessive relaxation, excessive, bordering on dullness. So you have to balance that. There's a real balance between attention and relaxation. That's one of the main areas of balance here. So if you have been in a situation where you've over relaxed, maybe you've noticed some involuntary movement of your body, some involuntary movement of the eye. Now, this is different from people shaking. Sometimes the inner energies are really buzzing and you kind of, I'm not talking like that. But you know when sometimes you're just on the brink of sleep and you just do like this, it's like a twitch. That's when that happens, it's a strong possibility that you've actually gone into too much relaxation. So watch your body. Involuntary eye movements is also a very, it's a good indication. Suddenly you find your eyes kind of moving around far too much. At this stage, because you're stirring up a deeper level of consciousness, there is a tendency when people get quite excited to start talking to everybody about their experiences in shamatha. You know, today I saw this and today I felt that, and you should have seen the dreams I have, and you know, the visions and all of that. I mean, there is a tendency. And every teacher says, just don't do this. Do not talk. The differences between practitioners are so varied that it doesn't help anyone by sharing that type of experience. It doesn't. Now, I'm not saying that if you don't have a trusted Dharma friend, yes, who's maybe studying shamatha with you, someone that you know and trust, of course you need to share, right? That's different. Dharma friends who are supporting you in this way. But you know what I'm talking about, right? This kind of excessive sharing about all the nice things, all the weird things that are happening. Maybe try not to do that. It won't help you. And it certainly doesn't help others. It really doesn't. And all this, what stage are you at? You know, what's not helpful. Really not helpful. None of it. Okay. The other thing I want to talk about, which I'm going to go into a bit more deeper later, is please, whatever arises, keep remembering, whatever mental images arise, gentle, violent, some of the most disgusting thoughts you've ever had, visions, coarse or subtle, short duration, long duration, good or bad, please, that's normal. When you're dredging the psyche, things will come up. Very, I mean, things come up from when you were quite young. Things will come up about incidents that you thought you dealt with sensibly, and, you know, this was a thing of the past, but still coming up. And it's been known that events, you can touch on events that happened in a different life, maybe not in this life at all. This is true. This is true. Once you start touching that substrate consciousness, then you're not touching a human consciousness here, really, very much. This is something that travels life. I'm not saying you'll do it. I'm not saying it's good if it happens. What I'm saying is, whatever comes, don't attach yourself to it. Don't get really very happy about the good things and very, very upset about the bad things. I'm saying that now. But look what happens now when we have grief. It overwhelms us. When something beautiful happens, it overwhelms us. Just normal, right? You can't afford to be overwhelmed doing shamatha practice. You're developing shamatha now. You're not a slave to your thoughts, ideas, or emotions. You're no longer a slave to this. You're observing their nature. You're seeing that they are not inherently existent in any way. And if you don't attach to it, it'll disappear. Now, if there is something that's coming up a lot and you need to talk to someone about it, then, of course, you know, you find a trusted friend, a trusted teacher, and maybe share that with them. So I'm not saying you're on your own. Not like that. But it's, don't behave like an ordinary person who's never heard of Dharma. Don't do that. Don't do that. Okay, so I said to you either yesterday or the day before, now that we're looking at the mind, like settling the mind in its natural state, mind in its contents, and then the next object will be awareness itself, although I'll explain that better. Whenever you're meditating on the mind, there are two types of meditations I've found that are very, very useful. One is nine-round breathing. Nine-round breathing. Are people familiar with nine-round breathing? Yeah? Easily Google Thubten Chodron, all of these. I mean, it's very well explained. Now, that's very good because it's dealing with energies in the two side channels and the central channel. Now, I'm sure you're all aware of that, but there's thousands, and there's something like 72,000 channels in the body. But here we're talking about three main ones. The central channel, which starts between the eyebrows, down in the front of the spine, and for this purpose is ending forefinger width below the navel. And then there's two side channels that follow but don't touch the central channel. And for the purposes of that, it enters the central channel. Why am I talking about central channels? Because the nine-round breathing is really about quickly settling the mind by moving the energies in these channels and clearing them of obstacles. Clearing the obstacles of the right side and of the left side. Okay. And that starts to help to converge these energies towards the central channel. It doesn't take it into the central channel, but it starts to move it in that direction. So nine-round breathing, very helpful for any meditation on the mind. However, gentle vase breathing is actually designed to get the energies which are normally flowing up and down the right channel, allowing them to settle, enter the central channel. Now, normally that doesn't happen unless you're very adept at highest yoga tantra. Unless you're dying, it happens naturally when you're dying. And some very strong practitioners. That's full. When we talk about phase breathing, it's quite an in-depth practice. This practice is called gentle phase breathing. So it has aspects of that. It was encouraged that people try this from Pabansababa a lot of the Dzogchen practitioners, particularly I've heard of Dujong Limpa, saying it's not necessary, but you may find it helpful. So we're going to, I'm going to talk you through that now. Okay, just front load it, and then we're going to practice it within the meditation. So we're clear, not essential. It helps some people, other people don't find it useful at all. I would say it's worth practicing. Don't make your decision straight away. Get used to the practice. And then further down the road, see if it's helpful. Okay. Anyone practice vase breathing before? Gentle vase breathing? Yes? Good, Anne? Yeah? Tilia?
I'm not quite sure exactly what it is. Just pulling the air up three parts breathing.
Okay, I'm going to talk you through this now. Okay, so what Dujong Limpa is saying is before you do settling the mind in its natural state, before you do awareness, then he's recommend. Now, this is outlined very clearly on page 86 of Lama Allen's book. So don't worry about that. Just listen to me now and think about it. It's very gentle, very easy. You sit upright. This is not to be done lying down, okay? Sitting upright in a comfortable position. And what you're doing is you're going to practice breathing until you get a feeling of the energies converging and entering the central channel, four finger widths below the navel, okay? So what are you doing? So you breathe normally to start with. And then you choose a few breaths. And what happens is on the in-breath, you allow the internal air. So you're breathing in right down to the abdomen. And you allow the abdomen to become full, like a little pot belly. Then as you breathe out, this pot belly slightly goes flat, but not completely. So you breathe in right down to your belly and your belly becomes slightly rounded and you hold it, not hold it, but you keep it slightly rounded at the lower abdomen, just below the navel. When you breathe out, it deflates slightly, but not completely. So you always have a slightly rounded lower abdomen. Some of the old-fashioned pictures of the Buddha, when they always depict the Buddha with a slightly rounded pot belly. This is really what it's meant to be. It's not that he overate. It's really relating to the meditation practice. So you breathe in, down to the belly, allow the belly to become rounded. Now, just by focusing in that area of the lower abdomen, four finger widths below the navel, you're pinpointing that central channel, the area of the central channel. So that's helpful. As you breathe out, there's a slight deflation in your lower abdomen, but you keep a feeling of fullness, a feeling of roundness, and you keep it. The next in-breath, again, you go from being slightly rounded to fully rounded. And then on the out-breath, slight deflation, keeping it slightly rounded. And that's what's called gentle vase breathing. What your goal here, Dujong Limpa says, is what that allows is the energies that are normally in the side channels, it allows them to enter the central channel. There is nowhere I can find where it says what it feels like. Yeah. It's a practice I do, but I can't tell. I just do it because at first it was very, very difficult and it gave me too much to think about. Ooh. But I found it so useful when I was walking. And I got so used to it when I was doing walking meditation that now it just feels normal to do it. Some people dismiss it completely because there's so much to keep your mind on. This is just an extra. So it's something to worth practicing separately until you know how to do it well. And then gradually introduce it and see if it helps. This entering of the energies from the side channel to the central channel, it's, they say that it's very helpful because it starts to loosen the knots there that's around that central channel. It helps to loosen the knots. And if the knots become loose, then you've got a chance of the energies flowing. Now, normally that energy doesn't flow, even doesn't even flow in the right direction, but it doesn't flow unless you're doing highest yogi tantra practice. Although at the time of death, flows naturally. The time of death. This is why how to die is useful, because it happens naturally. You don't have to try it. This is a natural occurrence. So it's straightforward. Just think of it. Is that clear? Do you want me to say it again? Do you get any questions? Yes, Taylor?
Yes, Venerable Mary, I have a question. At what point is there like a number of breaths that you take until it's full? And when do you exhale fully? Do you ever exhale fully?
No. The idea, you're exhaling most of it, but you're just keeping that little bit with that little rounded pot belly. And there's, initially you could feel there's a bit of tension and you don't want that. But once you get used to it, you don't even notice. You just become used to meditating with a slightly rounded belly with the air. I'd love to say to you, 12 breaths will do it. 20, but I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm not a terribly sensitive meditator. I was never one of nature's meditators, so I'm certainly not very sensitive when it comes to this. So I tend to spend a few minutes doing it. And then I just move on, but trying to keep that. But I'd love to say I felt this energy. Not true, no. But if so many teachers say that it can be helpful, then I kind of think, well, who am I to say it's not, you know? It took a while to get used to it. Like I say, I practiced a lot. And when I spoke to Lama Allen, he said, try it when you're walking. And I couldn't believe how easy it was when I was walking. Jeez, I really got used to it then. And then I was able to then put it when I was sitting and meditating, and now I hardly notice I'm doing it. But again, it's not indispensable. It's just an addition that many of the Dzogchen and Kagyu practitioners have said might be useful. But always remember, don't get it mixed up with the full vase meditation. That's much more involved. Jenny?
So would that involve sort of with the locks and the locks sort of in the lower chakras and then sort of throat area? Is that?
I presume so.
Yeah.
All I can find is very broad descriptions. Now you get very deep descriptions in Tantra.
Mm.
Tantra go through all the different locks. But as you know, I mean, in Tantra, it's a much more involved practice. Mm. But this seems to be what the Dzogchen practitioners and some of the Kagyu say, it's very gentle form, but very, very gentle. And it can give you the edge. So it's that little bag I'm always talking about that you may never go into. If you learn how to do this, put it in that bag, then bring it out and try it. But like I say, I was able to learn how to do it to the best that I could, walking. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Raina?
Venerable Mary, just to be clear, so I'm not visualizing the channels. I'm just concentrating on the belly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four finger widths below the navel. Yeah. It's all very subtle, isn't it? And a lot of people, I know a lot of people just don't do this at all. And certainly there's nothing to say that this is part of it. It's just that these various Dzogchen masters and some Kagyu masters have said you might find this helpful. So, okay, good. So maybe now we settle again in nice position and we'll do the full meditation, but including the vase breathing, and see how we get on. We'll just take a minute or so to get yours. Yes, Anne?
So we all need to be seated, not lying for this, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Just to practice. But if you're doing this at home, you could be seated doing this and then just gently lie down. You know, so there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's certainly something that Lama Allen said. Because when I was doing a long retreat, I spent time in supine, sitting up, standing, you know, lots of different things. But for this, maybe best sitting up. Thank you. Okay. Oh, Alfredo?
Yeah, Mary. Now trying this sitting, I'm going to, as always, disconnect my camera. But is it okay if I suddenly think I would like to try it walking, as you mentioned before, to try it in this first try, just to stand up and continue following the instructions while walking in my room?
Okay, so my advice, only advice, is to do it exactly the position of sitting up. Learn how to learn the mechanics of it. And then, I mean, I'm not saying it'll work for you walking. It was just the advice that was given to me. It was easier. But learn it sitting, because we're going to go straight on to settling the mind. Okay? It's something that you develop. I developed it better as a separate practice until I got really used to it. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So please get yourself in a comfortable position. Drawing the mind inward. Now allowing your consciousness to sink down through your body, releasing any tension on the out-breath, becoming aware of where your body contacts the earth element, and where one part of the body touches another part of the body. On the in-breath, allowing awareness to emerge and flow through the whole body. At this stage, being what's called pot-filled, as you breathe in, filling your belly, moving the diaphragm, filling your chest, and then just simply releasing, as opposed to breathing out, just releasing the breath. Scanning the body, releasing any tension, and paying specific attention to your face and brow. It's a very important area. Continuing to breathe and release. Your attitude is ease and vigilance. Slightly elevating the sternum if you're sitting. Beginning to notice the tactile sensations of the feet, and then working your way up through the body to the crown of the head, noting any sensation, releasing on the out-breath, and from now on, avoiding all movement. In a moment, taking an initial breath, deliberately feeling, breathing in, feeling the belly, moving the diaphragm, filling the chest, and then releasing fully in your own time. And then allowing your respirations to flow naturally, imposing no rhythm, no influence, no preference. Simply allow the body to breathe. Noting the entire breath, the beginning, the middle, the end of the breath, any pauses, keeping your awareness sharp. And part of the mind gently notices if the breath is long or short, deep or shallow, slow or fast. Again and again, counteract any difficulty by relaxing even more deeply on the out-breath and allow the in-breath to flow in effortlessly like an incoming tide. Shifting your awareness now to the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. Again, noting the entirety of the breath, the beginning, the middle, the end, the pauses. Stay with that rise, the sensation of the rise and fall. Count, if that's helpful, 1 to 10, then back to 1. As before, on the out-breath, just release any involuntary thoughts, counteracting laxity by arousing your attention on the in-breath, counteracting excitation by relaxing more deeply on the out-breath. To encourage vividness, you raise your attention to a subtler object, the sensation of the breath at the nostrils or the upper lip. Being aware of the sensation of the ongoing flow of sensations, beginning, middle, end, pauses, always there. And counteract any difficulties in exactly the same way. If you find it useful, you can count. We're going to take a few minutes now to do some gentle vase breathing. So the breath you use is your normal flow breath. When you inhale, allow the sensation of the breath to flow down to the bottom of the abdomen, like pouring water into a vase. And your abdomen will round. When you exhale, don't let the abdomen retract completely. Exhale, but keep the abdomen slightly rounded with the belly soft. And with each in-breath, that will expand again. On the out-breath, it will contract, but not fully contract, always retaining a fullness. Let's try that just for 2 minutes. Now maintaining that slight fullness in the area of the abdomen, that slight roundness. Let your eyes be open. Let your gaze be vacant, resting in the space in front of you. Remembering no strain in the eyes, blink if you need. A kind of daydream with open eyes. Your object now is the mind itself, the domain of all mental events. If you want to imagine a flower and see it disappear and place your mind there, then do so. Not necessary, but it may help. Your object now is carefully observing all the events that arise within the mind without regulating them or evaluating them in any way. Let them come, let them go. No attraction to you, no repulsion, no preference. You do not care whether there are thoughts there or there are no thoughts. Thoughts are never the problem. Without grasping, without distraction. Even when thoughts are rushing through your mind, your awareness is always still. Dealing with any difficulties in exactly the same way. Releasing any excitation or anxiety on the out-breath and refocus. Dealing with any dullness by arousing your attention on the in-breath. There is always something to observe, the mind or anything that occurs within the mind. I'm silent now for the last 7 minutes. making a special effort to refocus, clarify the mind, clarify your attention for the next 3 minutes. Good. We won't discuss phase breathing, how you're feeling about it. No, just sit with it. Just sit with it. Reflect back on it. And we'll talk a bit more maybe another time, but not now. Okay. So now I'd like to go back to the Kamala Shila's stages of the path. If you've got that handout of that book, just to look at where we are at the moment. Okay. So you could see that by really by stage, the end of stage four, beginning of stage five, this is the time that you have, you know, your mindfulness is strong. And the mind that you have now, there is an opportunity, if you wish, to change your object to a subtler object. And that's where Lama Alan is suggesting, if you're going to do that, then consider doing settling the mind in its natural state. So then this progresses. So you've got stage six here, pacified attention. Again with this, what they say here is there's no resistance to training. For all of us, for the best intention in the world, there's always a wee bit of, you know, there's other things you could be doing, right? But here at this stage, there's no resistance to training at all. You know, you're very happy to go back into training here. But again, the major power here is introspection. That's your major, the power by which you achieve stage six is definitely introspection. But you still have medium laxity and you still have subtle excitation. So there's still work to do, but it seems more doable now. Okay, you've got rid of the biggest problem, which was gross laxity. You've already gotten rid of gross excitement. So you've got left medium laxity, subtle excitation. So stage seven, as you could see, is called fully pacified attention. And it's interesting. From what I've read, you have a pacification of attachment, melancholia, and lethargy. And this idea of melancholia, a slight depression, that comes up in a few of the texts. Almost like a kind of, not to worry if it happens, it's kind of normal. Don't know. But they mention it in a few ones. And of course, now the power of achieving stage seven is enthusiasm. Is enthusiasm. It's enthusiasm, that's the power that's driving you here. You still have a problem, but it's very, very subtle now. It's by this stage, it's very subtle laxity, very subtle excitation. Everything's very subtle, and you quickly deal with this. You very quickly deal with this. Then you get to stage eight, single-pointed attention. Now, what you've got here is you can sit for 3 hours plus, and your attention is sharp and clear and focused. You have no excitation. You have no dullness to any degree. At least 3 hours at this stage. More than that, you can do. Holding with great clarity the object of your attention. Again, it's enthusiasm that drives this. Now, what they say here is the only real problem that exists is right at the very, just a slight effort. When you notice your mind, maybe not, you see, at the moment, we describe dullness and laxity from our understanding, but at this stage, it's very subtle. But luckily, so's your mind. So there's still a slight effort here, not much, very slight effort to ward off slight, you know, the very, very slight dullness, very, very slight. You couldn't even call it subtle. It's just so slight either way, excitation, subtlety. So just the slightest effort. It's not that you still have subtle anxiety or subtle dullness, but what they talk about is you have a kind of, what's left is a kind of latent impression of anxiety, a latent impression of dullness. And these latent impressions are kind of impulses that could arise. It's extremely subtle. It's extremely subtle. At this stage, they give you analogies like, you know, of water going, it doesn't work for me. But at this stage, it says, really, your mind is like a calm ocean, undisturbed by winds. Just a calm ocean. Beautiful stage to reach. I'm stopping here because at this stage is when Lama Alan says, at this stage, you're now at a stage where you can choose an even subtler object if you wish. And that subtler object that he suggests or offers up for your scrutiny is awareness itself. Not aware of anything, simple awareness. And that's something that we're going to work on tomorrow. But again, always keep in your mind that you can choose one object and straight through to shamatha. You don't have to change. But there are advantages. There are advantages. Okay. So maybe taking a bit of a stretch now. Maybe a sip, a little bit of movement, because I'd like to do a bodhicitta meditation now. Bodhicitta is important at the beginning, middle, and end of shamatha practice. My feeling is the further you go, the further you develop it, the more important it becomes. Shamatha itself is meant to be very seductive, very seductive. It can pull you away, really. I mean, the sensations you have, the abilities that you have, the bliss, the non-conceptuality, the luminosity. It can, unless you have strong bodhicitta, willing to help others, then they say you just want to stay there. You know, it's like a pinnacle. But as Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, that we've achieved shamatha many times and in many lifetimes, and we're still here. Still suffering. So I'd like to do a meditation now on empathetic joy. Empathetic joy. So please get yourself into a nice position. Bringing the mind inward. Releasing on the out-breath. Brightening your mind on the in-breath. Just bring everything in now. When you're ready, just relax as much as you can. In your own time, take 3 breaths into the belly, moving the diaphragm into the chest. And then don't just breathe out, simply let it go. Do that 3 times, no effort on the out-breath. When you've done it 3 times, just then attend to the ordinary ebb and flow of your breath with relaxation, stillness, and clarity. Bring to mind a person you know who emits a sense of good cheer, well-being, has a very positive physical presence in the words that they use and the actions they perform. Bring this person to mind. Attend to that person with great joy. Let your heart be open. Take great delight in this person. Bring to mind another person for whom something wonderful has happened recently or in the past. Another person. that someone has something wonderful has happened to them in the past or in the present. And then increase your delight in this. Now attend to someone who is inspiring with their virtues. Someone that you know who is generous, kind, wise. And really rejoice again for this individual and for those that they benefit with these virtues. Now attend to your own life, your own virtues. Reflect on the times you have been inspired and that you have inspired others. Generate strong delight in your own virtues. We're not talking pride or arrogance here, just a delight in your own virtues. Allow that to arise. Consider that all sentient beings have this capacity. You become aware of this capacity in all sentient beings. No real difference. You can positively affect all sentient beings in this way. Allow a deep sense of gratitude and joy to develop within you. And when it's as strong as you can make it, stop all internal discussion and gently focus on that sense of gratitude and joy. Thank you. So with in the group discussion, just 15 minutes, with empathetic joy, how does that affect how you interact with others? Okay, if you're going to develop empathetic joy or increase your empathetic joy, how does that affect how you interact with others? And how do you know that you're successful in developing empathetic joy with others? So we're looking at other people. If you're developing empathetic joy, how do you know you're doing it right? What are you doing? How are you interacting with others that reflects that development of empathetic joy? And for your own sense, how do you know, what are you seeing when you, in yourself, when you're doing it right? How do you know you're doing it right? Okay? Just a little question. Nothing. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back. Before we have a little feedback on that, tomorrow morning, it's down on the timetable, teaching from 10 till 12, but I would prefer if you did personal practice tomorrow morning. For those of you who know what you're doing, no problem. You've done it before. If you want help, it's the same thing. So it's starting the morning with a strong bodhicitta meditation. Strong motivation bodhicitta meditation. I would then suggest some targeted reading, and I would start about page 85 if you have Lama Allen's book, and reread again about vase breathing in relation to settling the mind in its natural state. After a little bit of reading and a bit of a break, then please try again the vase breathing with settling the mind, with settling the mind. I think that would be more useful than more talk. And so we'll meet again at 2 o'clock. And then we'll start on shamatha without a sign, awareness of awareness. And we'll start with that tomorrow. Okay, so I'll ask you to discuss empathetic joy. As you know, this is one of the four immeasurables. So empathetic joy, it's interesting, isn't it? What you're looking at here is really the word I used a lot in the meditation, and not my meditation, this is straight from Lama Allen's book, so that when you go back to the book, it'll be very familiar to you, is the word delight, is the word delight, the most beautiful word. Empathetic joy really is taking delight in your own and other people's virtues, taking delight in their successes, taking delight in their joy. And to be authentic in taking delight in others, you have to take delight in your own qualities as well. Then when you put that to other people, it will be authentic. Okay? So if that's what empathetic joy is, how does that affect your behavior to others? What did you decide? Yes, Ali.
Elizabeth and I, we were together, and Elizabeth said a wonderful thing, which is that you smile and they smile back.
That's always,
you know, yeah. Which is a lovely, you know, simple.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I just think that's fantastic. If the first thing they see on your face is a smile, people relax. People just relax. So that's helpful. Thank you. How else does it affect your interactions with other people? Otherwise, it's only words. If we don't know how to put it into action, tricky. Yes, Mikhail.
Well, I noticed a very clear feeling when we did the meditation that when I was thinking about others who has that quality, that it struck me that, you know, and this sounds very horrible, but those are the people that I like. I try to like everyone, but, you know, they're just immediately very likable and very inspirational. And it's almost like the energy comes first, and then it doesn't really matter what is said after that. If the energy is bad, I won't listen, you know. But if there is some kind of this joy or enthusiasm or, you know, joy of life, I would call it, you know, it's like it just opened doors.
And it's like I said before, one of the antidotes to ill will and malice is well-being. It really is. If you have got that well-being and you're talking to someone else, they relax. Nothing nasty comes from someone who has a feeling of well-being. It doesn't.
Exactly. I had a lot of discussion with Alfredo. It was good to see him. It's been a long time. We're in the same Sangha here. So, and we talked about this also in relationship to difficult relations of close ones, you know, how important it is to come from a positive space ourselves, or we just repeat the same triggering and patterning and karmic patterning, you know, things like that. So, very good.
We're creatures of habit, what to do? What to do? Dharma, really? I mean, somebody said to me, this Dharma business is like brainwashing. I said, well, if you think of it as mind washing, I think that's fairly reasonable. Certainly, it's a whole different way of thinking. Getting out of those habits, not easy.
Can I say one last observation?
Of course.
One last thing was more of a personal nature, which was that I find that, you know, hopefully in time with me finding more joy that I feel like I'm finding with the years. I had a bit of a rough patch to start with. So, but the point is that, you know, there is also some challenge with allowing this both in myself and in my surroundings, in the sense that, you know, like a lot of my relations have been built around the old moody me. Yeah. So I have to let go of some of the relations I've had because they simply don't match the person I'm trying to become, you know.
Instant.
So there's an element of sadness or grasping or attachment there that have to be worked on to find.
There can be a sense of loss. That's true. Yeah. Oh, no, that's good. Thank you. Anyone else? How does it affect your relationship with others? Anne?
I think I tend to be very enthusiastic, and I think joy comes over through enthusiasm. But the affecting relationship with others, I think people trust you. Once you open up and you take an interest in them, the trust develops very, very quickly.
Yes.
And I find that's quite a good place to be in for you and for them. That,
I think it's a mark of success when people trust, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. When people trust you, that's a real mark of success. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'd like you to consider, when you're interacting with others, to develop empathetic joy. When you're attending to people, sometimes we attend to how they look, we attend to how they sound, we attend to how they negatively affect us, or we attend to how they positively attend us. William James says, really, attention is very selective. And for the moment, what you attend to is your reality. Now, if you take that on board, when you're interacting with others, attending to their virtues, attending to their little successes or great successes, attending to the joy that they've created in themselves and for others, if we're selective, we can attend to that. That's one way of interacting with others. For the moment, where you attend to is your reality. If attention is anything that's selective, you can have one person there and you attend on what? Positive, negative, how it affects you, last time you spoke. All of this is, not that that's not true, but if you're trying to develop empathetic joy and you've got a basis of really delighting and attending to your own virtues and successes, attend to theirs. Try to see that in them. Everybody's got successes. Everybody's got virtues. Everybody has caused joy in other people. So finding that and attending to that can change your mind hugely. Any time anytime the slightest, when you're interacting with others, anytime the slightest envy, just the slightest, arises, knock it on the head. It's not true. It's just not true. This envy does nothing but disturb your mind. The moment, just the slight cynicism, so easy. And people value cynicism. You know the type of thing, don't you? Oh, yeah, she's been very kind, yeah. Mind you, if I had her money, I would be the same. You know what I mean? It's just always that kind of tail end of a sting. So anytime any kind of envy, any type of cynicism, hit it on the head. It's just not true. Let that go. Just let that go. And in the same way, some of the signs of success could be the envy and cynicism not arising in your mind. Or if it does arise, you recognize it for what it is and deal with it. If you're finding real difficulty in focusing on, you know, delighting in others, about attending to other people's virtues, attending to their successes and joys, if you're having difficulty there, then the remedy there is meditation and loving kindness. That's the remedy. If you need the remedy, that's the remedy. But with each of these four immeasurables, we need to say to ourselves, not just know what it is, but how does that affect how I deal with others? And how do I know I'm doing it right? What's happening in me? You know, what are the changes in me? These are direct, this is not Mary. This is direct Dharma teachings. This is just bodhicitta, straight bodhicitta teachings. Straight bodhicitta teachings. But I think sometimes we don't emphasize, how does that affect how I interact with others? It doesn't, you don't often see an emphasis on, how do you know you're doing it right? What are you looking for in yourself? What changes are you looking for in yourself? Yeah, that's good. Thank you for that. Recognizing and attending to your own virtues, again, without arrogance. It's not pride or arrogance. This is something just recognizing. You see, there's a thing in Dharma, I'm never 100% always on board with this, but it's said that you can't recognize in others if you don't have it in yourself. That's what they say. Normally when they give that teaching, it's in relation to negativities. They'll say, you can't see jealousy in others unless you've got it in yourself. I'm not 100% convinced on that, I have to say, but it is a teaching of the Dharma. But here I see it front and center. If you do not have for yourself that type of attention, that type of delight, you will not be able to see it in others. This won't. It's clear that what you see in others, first you have to have in yourself. It's almost what you see in others is like a reflection. So you make sure the mirror is clean and the reflection is excellent. Straight bodhicitta teachings, really. Okay. So tomorrow morning, instead of coming to class, it's personal practice. Exactly. I mean, my suggestion would be, as I've said before, you know, and then in the afternoon, we'll go straight into, but it'll all be about awareness of awareness or shamatha without the sign. Thank you very much for today. Thank you for coming in, sharing with everybody. It's been brilliant. And so we'll remember the motivation we had right at the very beginning. Between then and now, so much positivity, so much positive karma created, easily lost, so easily lost. So just mentally directing it to what you want to achieve, what is it you want? Hopefully has a huge bodhicitta flavor. And prayers can help. So we'll do some prayers. Give our day to the Lama Sangi Drukyo Ne Drowa Che. solam gupam shum. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Nyan chog sem chog rinpo she ma ke pa dang ke vyur chi ke pa nyam pa me pa yam go ni gong du pel wa sho. For as long as space endures, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you very much. So enjoy your personal practice tomorrow, and I'll see you at 2:00.